This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
And I'm Bob Kinzel. We're broadcasting live in the noon hour from NPR's worldwide headquarters in Washington, D.C.
We're spending 2 days examining Vermont's congressional delegation, how it represents the interests of Vermonters, and the roles that the three members play in the politics of Capitol Hill.
Yesterday, we spent 90 minutes talking with the three members of Vermont's delegation, Peter Welch, Patrick Leahy, and Bernie Sanders. Today, we're going to spend some time talking about them.
We've convened a reporters' roundtable of some of the top journalists in Washington who cover Congress. Sungmin Kim, a congressional reporter for Politico, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Niels Lesniewski, a reporter for Roll Call. That's a news service from Congressional Quarterly. It's a pleasure to have you with us as well.
It's good to be here.
Now, we're all in the NPR studios, but it turns out the NPR reporter, David Wellna, is with us from the Capitol today. David, it's a pleasure to have you.
Hi, somebody has to hold down the fort here.
That's right. Yeah, you're getting things done there?
I'm watching things possibly getting done.
Well, that counts for something, I guess. So let's start just by examining a little bit what the perception of Vermont in general is in Washington, because, of course, we think of ourselves as, you know, the best state in the nation, very progressive, community-oriented, not necessarily the most liberal state in the nation. We had a Republican governor for 10 years before we got the Democrat who's in there now. Though we also know that the picture of our state from the outside may not quite be the same. We may be seen as, you know, neo-hippies, Ben and Jerry's, nice foliage, cheese. So, Sungmin, why don't you start? Is there a perception of Vermont here in Washington?
I think the perception, especially if you look at the three members of your delegation, they're consistently progressive, liberal, espouse those values. And that's sort of the impression that we get here in the Capitol. I mean, Senator Leahy and Sanders, you know where they're going to be on certain issues, on anything ranging from the budget to, you know, issues of national security and whatnot. Same with Congressman Welch. So that's how we, you know, that's sort of the presentation that they make for us here in the Capitol.
Niels, your thoughts?
Well, I would agree with that, and I would also, but I would also say that it is one of your former governors who ran for president not all that long ago, sort of helped Governor Dean, of course, who helped shape that view. Although I would say, and we'll probably get to this at some point later, that at least in recent history, the most consequential lawmaker on Capitol Hill from Vermont may well have been a Republican who left the Republican Party and then caucused with the Democrats, Jim Jeffords, back in 2001.
How did the Jim Jeffords switch from the Republican Party away from the Republican Party affect how people think of Vermont?
Well, it was sort of a larger view of the Republican Party than Vermont in particular, because Jeffords, of course, was a New England Republican. And New England Republicans are not the same breed necessarily as Republicans in other parts of the country. The fact that he was no longer comfortable with the Republican Party more broadly was perhaps as much a geographic issue as it was a broader statement about where politics had been going.
David Wellna, anything to add there?
I think that Vermont is seen as one of the bastions of liberal thinking in Congress. I guess California might be somewhat comparable, although California has many, many very conservative Republicans also representing it. Vermont is much more pure in the sense that it has three lawmakers who all vote fairly to the left side of the left side of the aisle. So yeah, I think that reputation in terms of who represents the state in Congress is pretty well deserved.
We do have the best ice cream, though. Can we just all establish that that's probably true?
I'll have to agree with you there.
Well, we certainly have heard a lot from the three members of the delegation about the current government shutdown. I think our listeners would be very interested to know, what role do any of them play in helping craft a solution down here? David?
Well, you know, the solution is probably going to be coming from Republicans rather than from Democrats. And Democrats can weigh in a lot on this, and certainly the three members of the Vermont delegation do. But I think everybody is looking both to Senate Republicans and also to House Republicans to come up with some kind of legislation that will reopen the government and extend the debt ceiling. And at this point, I think it's a question of whether someone like Peter Welch would actually vote for a six-week clean extension of the debt ceiling that the House Republicans are proposing, given the fact that they have not yet agreed to reopen the government. And I was speaking with some House Republicans just about an hour ago who said that they're not sure that they have all the votes that they would need to get to 217, which is the magic number right now, to get a bill through only with Republican votes. So they're all looking to the White House to give its blessing on this proposal that was floated last night. And they're not looking so much to Senate Democrats to give their blessing.
Although, Bob, I don't know how you felt on the show yesterday. We had the three members of our delegation. It looked like Peter Welch was pretty open to that idea of extending the debt ceiling, doing that six-week extension. And it was, of course, David, as you mentioned, the Senate Democrats who were saying that's probably not going to fly here.
Well, the problem is that the House Republicans have not yet agreed to reopen the government. And
right.
I think you could find probably 200 Democrats in the House chamber willing to vote for this if they would reopen the government right now, too.
And Sungmin, you cover the House. You cover Representative Welch. Where do you see him in this whole budget impasse and the role that he might be playing?
He's played one very clear role, which is to kind of help keep the Democrats in line with trying to make sure that his party doesn't give on the issues of making a lot of big concessions to Republicans on the debt ceiling. 2 years ago, he spearheaded this letter campaign during the last debt ceiling crisis that we had in the summer of 2011. He circulated a letter that got we were talking about this a couple days ago, actually. Got a little over 100 members of the Democratic caucus on board saying we won't support something that's not a clean debt ceiling. We don't want any concessions or spending cuts or whatnot made to Republicans in this, because we should, you know, as the United States, we should be paying our bills. That's just what this nation does. And he was telling me a couple days ago that he spearheaded that letter writing campaign again this year. And now he's got 187 signatures on that letter, including all five members of leadership, which is a dramatic change from what was going on in 2011. And he has helped kind of bring the Democratic caucus together on that position, saying we can't give to Republicans anymore.
Niels, Senator Patrick Leahy is the senior member of the U.S. Senate. Is he in Harry Reid's leadership circle?
Well, Senator Leahy is not a member of the leadership team per se. He's a very sort of influential voice within the Democratic caucus in the Senate, and particularly on a whole array of issues. But when it comes to the sort of budget debates, Senator Leahy is a longtime member of the Appropriations Committee. He's chaired or been the ranking Democrat in the minority on the panel that oversees the State Department's budget for longer than I can recall. And he actually passed up the opportunity to become the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, which he had the opportunity to do with basically following the death of Daniel Inouye.
So how much of a surprise was that? Up in Vermont, there was a lot of debate about that decision. How was it viewed down here that Senator Leahy said, you know, I don't want to be the chair of the Appropriations Committee. I'm going to stay at Judiciary.
Well, it was sort of a shock to the system in the traditional way that the system has run here, because the way it normally worked was it didn't matter what your gavel was, it didn't matter what you were in charge of previously, that if you had the chance to jump to appropriations, that you would. But I'll say two things about this decision that have made it really interesting the way that this year has gone. One, with all the intelligence disclosures and all those sorts of security issues, some of which I'm sure that Senator Leahy would have spoken with you folks about, having him retain the gavel at the Judiciary Committee became very important because he does not see eye to eye with Dianne Feinstein, the California Democrat who was in line to succeed him on those issues. And the other thing is that when Leahy took a pass, it laid the groundwork for Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski to become the chairwoman of the appropriations panel, and that has seemed to be a really good fit for her.
I would add one other thing, too, and that is that since both the House and the Senate have at least officially dropped earmarks, that is, carving out spending that is obligated to certain projects in lawmakers' districts or states, having a seat on the Appropriations Committee just isn't the joyful thing that it used to be. You cannot bring home exactly. the bacon just to your district the way you used to. And it's kind of a sad task these days, especially given sequestration and the fact that you're seeing spending being cut everywhere. It's not a very celebratory thing, I think, to be on these committees. And I think that Leahy's turning down the chance to chair that committee really sort of signaled the death of the vaunted cardinal system on these committees. You know, John McCain used to say that there are Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators. Well, I think that last group may not be relevant anymore.
Well, that's all right. Senator Leahy already has, I think, a dozen or more centers and you know, buildings and chairmanships and things named after him in Vermont. So he's okay on that front. We are broadcasting today from Studio 32 at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., and we're talking with Beltway reporters about how Vermont's congressional delegation is perceived here in the nation's capital. If you'd like to chime in, listeners, with your thoughts or questions, you can post them at vpr.net/Vermont Edition or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Again, that number is 1-800-639-2211. So let's not forget about the most colorful member of our delegation, Bernie Sanders. You know, he seems to be the one that draws the biggest cult following outside of Vermont. You see his speeches and his impassioned pleas go viral on Facebook and other social media. And I want to play you something that he said yesterday on the program when we had the full delegation on.
The problem that we are having right now is in that other body in the House of Representatives. That body has been captured. And you have to use the word right-wing extremists who, you know, are, I mean, what can you say? They are prepared to bring the United States financial system and the world's financial system to a halt if they don't get their way.
Would they call you a left-wing extremist? Well, I mean, are they feeling the same way about you?
Why? Because I defend Social Security and I think that we should pay our bills and I don't think we should shut down the government because in order to deny health care to 20 million people, I guess, does that make me an extremist? I don't think so.
All right. That is classic Bernie. You know, we hear that speech all the time. But what I'm curious about, David Welna, is what do the other senators think of Bernie? I mean, when he gets on the floor and starts talking about Social Security, does everybody roll their eyes or does it actually move the needle at all in Washington?
There are many Democrats in the Senate who are completely on the same page with Bernie Sanders when it comes to defending Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits. It's definitely the left wing of the Democratic caucus in the Senate that is with Sanders on these issues. But I think that he is articulating the viewpoint of many voters, not just in Vermont, but across the country, who are not hewing necessarily to the political center. A lot of politicians feel, at least on the Democratic side, feel safer moving towards the center. But I think Bernie Sanders is somebody who kind of lets his freak flag fly in the Senate, and his colleagues, I think, are very tolerant about that. I haven't heard anyone speak ill of Bernie Sanders among his Democratic colleagues.
But, Niels, you know, you could have, if you could gerrymander a district so that it didn't just include Vermont, sure, Bernie Sanders could have a very large constituency of progressive left-wing people who really love what he says. But again, he's going to be only one vote in the Senate.
Well, I think that what would be the most interesting thing to see, although I'm sure that the Vermont delegation and probably the bulk of the voters in Vermont would not necessarily like to see this, the point at which Senator Sanders would be most fascinating would be in the minority, because Senator Sanders holds his beliefs in such a way that you wonder – would Senator Sanders, when he can use his one vote to filibuster or block a Republican Senate agenda a Republican president's agenda, to what extent he would do that in the future. I'm sure that, you know, you might well see that on an issue like if there were to be another Iraq war sort of situation, that he may well be on the floor every day trying to slow down that effort as much as possible.
Well, he made a stand on tax cuts for the rich being extended, and it was a bit like Ted Cruz's faux filibuster. He got up and he just spoke for hours, even though he wasn't going to delay any vote on the issue. I think that's probably been his greatest hour of glory up here.
Yes, and you can now buy the book that has the full script
right,
of that
yeah.
speech.
Niels, Senator Sanders is an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats, and for that reason, he's the chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Veteran Affairs. He's very involved in issues affecting veterans. He talks about this a lot in Vermont. What's his reputation as the head of this committee?
Well, that's remains largely an open question. I don't think people would question Senator Sanders' commitment to veterans, but it's just he's only had that gavel since the beginning of the year. Patty Murray, a Washington State Democrat who's now chairing the Budget Committee, was running the Veterans Affairs Committee up to this Congress. And largely, as with Veterans Affairs, as with a whole host of other issues, I'm sure Sung Min would bring up immigration if we were to go there. Very important issues. There's an awful backlog in veterans claims, but there's not really enough time for Congress to address it right now because they're mired in government shutdown, standoff to standoff.
And I think in his role as the chairman of that committee, speaking of the current government shutdown, he has taken a lead role in emphasizing how the shutdown affects veterans. So that's been, you know, every member of the Senate Democratic Caucus has a different message on what they're pushing and how, you know, in how the shutdown affects, you know, America. And that's been he's been the voice on that issue.
I think there's a certain irony, too, that Bernie Sanders is the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee because he himself is not a veteran. And he, in fact, opposed most of the conflicts that these people are veterans of. He has been a fierce advocate for them in terms of defending their benefits.
Shrewd move, David Wellman, to join that committee then?
Well, I don't know if he needed that kind of political cover on his part. It's a committee that's not sort of on the A-list of committees, but it's one where I think he can show his commitment to keeping up the government's commitments to these people, and it's kind of an extension of his never-ending campaign to defend Social Security.
We're talking with national congressional reporters about the leadership roles of the Vermont delegation and how they advance both national and local politics. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition, coming to you today from NPR Studios in Washington.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
And I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, Vermont Edition is broadcasting live for the second day from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. We're talking with congressional reporters about how Vermont's politicians operate in the nation's capital.
And joining us are Politico's Sungmin Kim, Roll Call's Niels Lesniewski, and NPR's David Wellna.
And if you have questions for them, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Eugene in Winooski. Hi, Eugene. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I'd like to say a few things about Mr. Sanders. I've sat and eaten a meal with him and talked genuinely with him. He's a real person. He knows what's going on. And it's funny, I hear Jane giggle when she talks about Bernie not being part of the establishment, the Republican-Democrat establishment. I wonder if Jane knows that those are two parts to the same coin, and they don't care which way we vote as long as they get their Democrats and Republicans in, because they're all controlled. Do you know that, Jane?
Eugene, I hear what you're saying. I didn't mean to giggle. I think what we can see when we look at the delegation, though, is that Bernie Sanders is the most willing to go to an extreme, the most willing to buck the trend, the most willing to talk passionately about things that perhaps our other members of the delegation are likely to be a little bit more circumspect. Peter Welch, we certainly see trying to work across the aisle more than his colleagues. And so, you know, I think when we see Bernie Sanders, there's a real difference between him and the other members of our delegation. Thanks very much for the call, Eugene. And speaking of which, let's talk about Peter Welch.
Let's talk about Peter Welch, Sungmin. Peter Welch is a co-founder of a group called the Problem Solvers. They've got about 40 House Republicans, 40 House Democrats. He talks about this group a lot in Vermont, and he touts the work of the organization. He thinks this is the way to get through and to make some progress in Congress. How is that group viewed down here?
That group is not very prominent, but in terms of his ability to work across the aisle, I mean, he is, you know, clearly a progressive. I mean, you don't have to question where he is on essentially every issue. But the fascinating thing about Peter Welch is how he's able to cultivate these bipartisan relationships on these issues. I mean, I believe, you know, earlier, or I think it was last month, he had, or you know, within the last couple of months, he had co-sponsored a bill with Michelle Bachmann. That was very interesting. The Republican from Minnesota, clear, you know, proud member of the Tea Party, ran for president in the last cycle. But the fact that he's been able to work with very conservative members such as Michelle Bachmann, the more moderate Republicans, I believe he's teamed up with some moderates from Republican moderates from New York on other issues as well. So it kind of gets him this reputation as a progressive pragmatist, if you will.
Well, yesterday on the program, Representative Welch said both Republicans and Democrats share some of the blame for the current budget impasse. And he said there are no winners in this debate.
And whose ever at fault is really of less consequence than the institution is failing. It's bad for the country. So I actually don't like that rhetoric. We've got a real problem. I think it's important for us to try to explain as best we can who's doing what. But bottom line here, there is something I think that Vermonters understand, and that is you do pay your bills. You know, because you're mad at the plumber, you don't stiff the electrician.
So, David, while other Democrats are using very harsh language to criticize the Republicans, Representative Welch is taking a different approach. Is that typical of his reputation down here in Washington?
Yeah, he's a pretty level-headed lawmaker, I'd say, and one who is not antagonistic towards Republicans. He's very media savvy. You often will see him on cable TV stations holding forth, as does Bernie Sanders, I should add, not so much with Leahy. But he's somebody who is able to communicate his message to much wider audiences than just his colleagues here in Congress. And I mean, I think it's also very impolitic for Democrats in general to appear to be happy about what's going on with the shutdown, even though they figure that this is only going to help them politically because they see the blame falling much more on Republicans than Democrats. But it behooves them not to show any glee over this.
Representative Welch also took on a leadership role 2 years ago, 4 years into his tenure here in the House of Representatives, and he is now one of the deputy chief whips. But, Niels, does that make any difference? I mean, there are 10 deputy chief whips. So does it make any significant difference in having that kind of role?
Well, any sort of leadership role gives you a seat at the table and at least in theory more access to someone like the party leader, Nancy Pelosi, and Steny Hoyer, who's the whip of the Democrats in the House, but really at this point it's sort of the way that the House Democratic Caucus seems to be set up is that there's both a formal leadership structure and a somewhat more informal leadership structure. Where on these budget issues, you will see that it's Chris Van Hollen, who's a Democrat from Maryland, the ranking member on the Budget Committee. Who is normally the one who's their spokesperson on those sorts of issues. But it can't hurt to have a foray, particularly when you get to an issue where there might not be everyone else as involved. The Farm Bill comes to mind as a case where that might be, where someone from Vermont would be very interested in it, but someone from San Francisco may not be.
As we discussed earlier in the program, Senator Leahy is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's pushing for major changes to the Patriot Act to make it harder for the government to monitor the emails and phone calls of Americans. As we know, some members of the Senate Intelligence Committee say the current system has thwarted dozens of terrorist attacks. And yesterday on this program, he challenged that assertion.
When we asked him specifics, that went from 53 or 54 down to maybe 30 to 20, to finally they said, well, maybe in one case it was essential. My question is this. You could have total security if you have somebody following every single person in this country. We're not a police state. We're always going to be face threats of terrorism. But how much do we want to give up of our privacy?
So, David, help us understand, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, how much does Leahy determine the agenda of the panel, and what's his reputation?
Well, he has a lot of say over which hearings they're going to hold and which ones they're not going to hold. He is the chairman, after all. They don't take votes on what the agenda is supposed to be. But he, of course, talks to his members, and he talks to Chuck Grassley, the ranking Republican, quite a bit, too. The two have a fairly cordial relationship. They sometimes lock horns in public on different issues. But I think that Leahy's activism on the whole issue of government snooping, to me at least, seems a bit like buyer's remorse. He, of course, along with 98 other senators, voted for the Patriot Act. Russ Feingold, a Democrat from Wisconsin, who's now a former senator, was the only one who voted against it at the time. I think Leahy's had many second thoughts about that, and this is one way of expressing it.
We are talking today about how our congressional delegation is perceived in Washington. EC2 posted, "My educated guess is that inside the Beltway folks perceive the Vermont delegation as follows. Leahy, given his seniority and position as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is about as influential as you can get. Sanders is an important progressive voice, but too far to the left of the mainstream to have much influence. And Welch, as a low-profile member of the House Minority Conference, is just a workaday congressman." Sungmin, does that register?
There's a bit of a truth in those assessments. I think that in regards to Bernie Sanders, and we touched on this earlier, he is probably among the first, if not first, thorns in President Obama's side. If the administration comes up with something that he doesn't like, that progressives don't like, Social Security is the best example that we can think of. So we know that, you know, once a lot of times when there are these major budget compromises that the edges of neither party really like, or actually no one really likes, he is always the first to speak out against it and make his position very clear.
Niels, let's just take a step back here for a couple moments that we have left and talk a little bit about how you, reporters in Washington, cover what we're dealing with right now with this budget impasse, because there are a couple of different ways that it's being perceived and covered. And I'm curious how philosophically you approach this. You work on the blog for Roll Call. I mean, how do you deal with the different sides in this debate and everybody sort of coming at you no matter which side you work on?
Well, it's often difficult because the influx of information that you have to sort through and determine, okay, well, there's two sides of this. There's the sort of figuring out what's going on behind closed doors in the rooms, whether they're in the Senate side of the Capitol or at the White House or in the House. And then there's also the question of when they actually put a proposal on the table or a proposal surfaces and leaks out of one of these rooms, is this proposal what it says to be? And I'll do one quick example. There was a proposal that came out of the House that would repeal this sort of excise tax on medical devices, which is a largely unpopular tax even with Democrats and Republicans. But it also costs almost $30 billion to get rid of. And so that first version of the proposal didn't pay for it. And so that was something that had to be pointed out by the media even before the Democrats had actually picked up on it.
We got about a minute left, Sungmin. I'm wondering, some criticism I hear of the media is that the media is reporting this issue as having two sides, and there's legitimacy to both sides, the Republican side, the Democratic side. As a reporter, how do you wrestle with that?
I think, first of all, it is our job to present both those sides. They're not always 50-50. I think and especially you have to look at what the polls say. And I think especially what you've seen the last couple of days in terms of who is at blame in this crisis. Clearly, Republicans have borne the blame because of their push to defund the president's health care law in the government shutdown fight, which was a very unpopular tactic. All the way around, except for the conservatives parts of their party. But at the same time, I think the dynamic has changed at this point after the government shut down. Now it's almost a pox on everyone's house at this point. And so it's kind of our job to present what's going on. And that includes, you know, what Republicans have to say and what Democrats have to say and kind of go along with it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. But thank you to all three of you very much for being part of this discussion, helping us illuminate what the delegation looks like outside of Vermont. Really appreciate your time.
Great to be here.
You're welcome.
We were speaking with Sungmin Kim, who reports on Congress for Politico. Niels Lesniewski is a reporter for Roll Call, a news service from Congressional Quarterly. And David Wellna, who joined us from the Capitol, is a congressional reporter for NPR.
Now, coming up, one reporter tells us what she really thinks of covering the Capitol.
You know, someone told me when I first came to cover the Capitol that the longer I would be here, the more respect I would have for the building and the less respect I would have for the members in it.
This is Vermont Edition, coming to you today from NPR Studios in Washington. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. We're broadcasting today from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Throughout the federal government shutdown, public opinion of Congress has been extremely low. And so is public opinion of the media that's meant to cover Congress.
One close observer of Washington politics has tapped into the feelings of distrust of both institutions. Andrea Seabrook is a journalist who runs the blog and podcast Decode D.C. Previously, she covered Capitol Hill for NPR.
On Wednesday, our managing producer, Patty Daniels, sat down with Seabrook in the empty rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building.
Andrea Seabrook, welcome to Vermont Edition. Thanks for being our guide in the Capitol today.
It's a pleasure.
When you see congressional leaders talking across each other through the media, mm-hmm. what is some of the backstory that you're interpreting as you see that unfolding?
One thing they're doing that I think a lot of people pick up on is actually negotiating, putting ideas out there very carefully. They seem nonchalant, but very carefully about how this thing might work out. President Obama yesterday tossed out this almost throwaway line, you know, they could just pass a clean CR while we negotiated this. You know, it seemed like almost nothing, but it was an idea that might work, that might actually be workable to end the shutdown, at least for the short time being. Speaker Boehner comes out not 15 minutes later and says in his own press conference down the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, saying, no, we're not going to do that. But he also didn't mention the Affordable Care Act. And the fact that he didn't mention Affordable Care Act and only talked about spending means that he's signaling that perhaps something could be worked out on the spending side and we could drop all this business about the law, the Affordable Care Act. The other thing that's going on when you hear that is so much of this is about public opinion, who Americans think are to blame for this. You know, they're using this incredibly strong language to make themselves seem like the ones who are the victims in a situation. The funny thing is that when you actually take what they say at face value, none of it is really surprising. None of it is new. It appears to be the same thing every day. And none of it is bald-faced honest. This is all posture and subtle diplomacy.
So when you look back over the decade that you've spent covering Capitol Hill, do you feel like what you just described that's happening now is significantly different than maybe 10 years ago? Or is this just a new iteration of a perennial problem?
It's definitely worse now. Absolutely. That's not to say that it is worse than it has ever been.
The real difference is that the Republican Party is in a struggle for its soul right now. It is completely unified. The Republican Party is almost always the party of party loyalty, the top-down party. They are in line, and they know what they're saying, and they follow their leaders. That's not happening now. This is a wave, a political wave shift that is still shaking out from the 2010 midterm elections. With a party in such disarray, it's difficult for the whole place to work because that party right now is in control of one of the chambers. And so regardless of the politics or what any person, any American thinks of what should be done, the system itself cannot function when a part of it is so broken.
So when you look at some of the fault lines around what has created this dysfunction, people point to gerrymandered districts where the seats are not competitive. Is there a bigger picture than that that's causing some of this problem?
It's absolutely true that the districts, congressional districts around the country, are far more to the ends of the political spectrum, both on the Democratic and the Republican side, than the actual people in the United States. So in some ways, it appears that the House and the Senate represent Americans well, but in fact, it's a very poor representation of American values. We seem to speak to each other as if having different political views meant you are a different kind of person, an untrustworthy person, somebody who you wouldn't want to babysit your child. You know, there's this real rift. I think that begins to shred the basic premise of American democracy, which is that we are one, and we together are interested in the best possible future. When you lose that, it's just fighting. It's just all-out war all the time.
The way you were describing a system functioning well sounds almost idealistic. What actions could individual members be taking mm-hmm. that might bring the system back to what you were describing as an ideal of how it ought to work?
Right. And you're absolutely right. It is idealistic. I'm not naive about the place either. I've always described it as the great train wreck of ideas. You know, you sort of have this mess constantly, and that's part of the fun of covering it. The thing that I think members of Congress could do, senators could do, and frankly all of us could do, is try harder to listen. We are all doing a great job at advocating for ourselves right now. We're doing it very effectively. What we are not doing is listening to the needs of our fellow Americans. I love this place for its clash of ideas. And it is so sad that we can't have the argument robustly and then come to a solution. You know, I left my job at NPR, a place I love, because I couldn't stomach covering the place anymore. And that's the fault of the place.
You mentioned that you left NPR to start Decode DC. Mm-hmm. And I've heard people refer to that name, Decode DC, and think, well, that's a grand ambition. I don't think anyone can decode DC. What kind of journalism are you trying to provide in this project?
I'm trying to step away from the daily back and forth. You know, when did Obama move his little pinky finger? What expression did John Boehner have on his face? Kind of journalism, day by day. And tell the broader stories. Tell exactly these broader stories of the value and the operation of our democracy. I want to explain how it works and how it doesn't. I want to explain the problems and how we got here. And mainly, Decode DC as a project starts from the assumption that the system is broken. It never, you know, and so that completely changes the way you act about your journalism. I never take at face value anything that any member of Congress or senator says, or the president, because they are operating within a broken system. And I stay away from false equivalencies. I'm never going to say that
climate change may be happening, but some people don't believe in it. That's playing politics. That's allowing your journalism to be skewed by politics.
Is the concern among journalists that they will be perceived as partisan, or is the concern that their reporting would compromise their access to the people they're trying to report on?
Both. Both things are going on at the same time. Right now, I think the stronger of the two influences on journalists is the access question, because in newsrooms, you are seen as a powerful journalist, a great journalist, an important journalist. If you have access to the top players, you prove your mettle in many ways in a newsroom by getting access, by gaining that over time. Anybody can watch John Boehner on C-SPAN now, but if you have the power to go up and talk to him and he'll talk to you, then you have, you know, you're a powerful journalist. People often are not willing to ask the hard and sometimes impolite questions because they will get cut off from those members of Congress, those senators. Getting back to your original question, there is also the problem of objectivity or appearance of objectivity. When your compass points anywhere but towards your own personal understanding of the truth, the valid points of each side of an argument, if you are following some other ideal, like appearing to be objective or getting access, you can't report the truth.
So we've talked a little bit about the roles that the politicians have. We've talked a little bit about the roles that the media have. What roles do you think that people who are consuming the news, constituents, voters, have in trying to right this ship?
I think one of the things each of us can do in our daily lives is recognize that our own political views are often shaped by what the parties say, and those parties are acting in their own best interest a lot, oftentimes. Ask yourself, how much progress is made? How much progress has been made when my party is in power on the issues I care about? And I think if all of us were more critical and didn't just side out of sheer partisan loyalty with one side or the other, but expected more of those parties or those members of Congress, then we would be in a better position to be critical and go vote on voting day, regardless of the party that's in place. I think another thing that people could do is, along those lines, is drop that stuff. Take a look at the people who are running for office and not the parties that are running for office. And I think some people could run. I think there are a lot of people who are tired of this.
Andrea Seabrook, the journalist and force behind Decode DC, thank you so much for your time today.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you, Patty.
That's journalist Andrea Seabrook of the blog and podcast Decode DC. She spoke earlier this week with managing producer Patty Daniels.
And before we leave today, we'd like to read a few of your comments to yesterday's program with the Vermont Congressional Delegation. We spent 90 minutes with Senators Sanders and Leahy and Congressman Welch, and we heard from many of you.
Wixie wrote, "How the press allows these three to get away with the hopeless spin doctoring, I will never understand."
Trudy seems to agree. She wrote on our Facebook page, "Listening to this is making me sick. No solutions, just the blame game. Can we send them all packing and start over?"
Jacques from Mansfield has found a silver lining to the government shutdown. Machine gun, artillery, and rifle fire are no longer disturbing the peace in Jericho and Underhill. The quiet reminds me of the Vermont I used to know.
On behalf of the Leaf Peepers, Jacques writes, please extend a thank you to Speaker Boehner.
Now, Sue has a unique suggestion for solving the government shutdown. She's a speech therapist in central Vermont. She writes, "I look at our Congress as a child with a communication problem, no social language, no respect for other people, no give and take. I'm serious in suggesting Congress consult with both a speech therapist and a kindergarten teacher. The teacher will help Congress learn to get along and to be respectful to others and how not to bully.
Well, Cindy from Bonneville has another interesting suggestion. She says perhaps some fresh Ma Beans Vermont apple pie and Vermont ice cream across the table could help solve this crisis. The apples are especially good this year.
We'll take that under advisement, Cindy. Thanks for all your comments.
By the way, if you missed yesterday's show with all three members of Vermont's congressional delegation, you can listen back to it by going to vpr.net.
Or find Vermont Edition on Facebook to see the behind-the-scenes photos from Washington and to share your thoughts.
That wraps up our 2 days here in Washington, D.C. We've been coming to you live from brand new studios at NPR.
Vermont Edition's broadcasts from Washington are produced by Patty Daniels with support from Rick Sangari, Sage Van Wing, and Tim Johnson. Peter Biello and Chris Albertine engineered today's program from Vermont.
Our engineering team at NPR in Washington is Melissa Marquis, Chris Nelson, and Zach Coleman. Special thanks as well to NPR's Emily Dagger.
Funding for this project was provided by the VPR Journalism Fund. I'm Bob Kinsel.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a great weekend.